Sarah was a chemical engineer, and she was excelling at her career. Her boss loved her and kept giving her raises, and we were married for about 5 years, and then we decided we're going to have kids, and she came into that as with all the energy of her career success, knowing the implications of raising kids and what it was going to cost. I think there's a lot of people who just have this kind of idealized version of what it means to start a family. Just, I guess, on Mother's Day, I just want to celebrate my wife because she threw all of that career energy into her kids. And I think I'm seeing the results in a pretty major way. She's the best mom I've ever seen. I mean, she's in close proximity to me. But the fact is, it takes time and energy and resources to form and disciple human beings, especially little ones like this that demand all of your energy. I think throughout the pregnancy it was interesting because I think she was maybe a little closer to the idea that we were about to have a son because she could feel him moving. She could feel her body changing. I could see that externally, but for me it was more just like head knowledge. I didn't have firsthand knowledge. I had this idea that I'm becoming a father. But it wasn't until he came out and I saw a face that it went from my head into my whole body. Like, it permeated my soul. And I recognized him. That intense, focused look. And I remember they pulled him over to that warming table and he laid there and he was just looking around all over the place in wonder, and I got down about a foot away from him and his eyes just locked right onto mine and wouldn't move. And it was like, I felt like he found what he was looking for as he'd been looking around. Babies, I think, just assume that someone is looking for them. Their whole world revolves around being recognized for the person that they are, known and loved, even though they don't even know it, but intuitively it's like built into them. Studies show that even moments of neglecting, like just brief moments of neglecting face-to-face interaction with an infant or a young child, can distress them deeply. I found some research just kind of thinking about our screens as we've been talking about technology. When pairs of strangers, even adults, are asked to have a meaningful face-to-face just conversation, their ability to connect emotionally was significantly reduced if a mobile phone was visible and not even on. Another study showed that infants showed just unhappiness, fewer positive emotions, and even an unwillingness to play with their toys when their mother looked at her device for as little as 2 minutes in the room. I remember holding Emery in the middle of the night and just willing him to sleep. Because I wanted to sleep, and he just laid there in my arms, you know, less than a foot away, just staring into my eyes, just calm. Comfortable, secure, full of the knowledge that he was held by someone who loved him and would do anything for him. And I think though those moments have probably faded from his conscious memory, their imprint runs deep as a foundation, fortifying his character and ultimately his resilience, which is the title of our sermon series that we're going probably all the way up until Thanksgiving-ish. Resilient. God has designed people to be resilient in the face of the onslaught of the storm. And in Matthew, he ended the Sermon on the Mount, all these practical tangibles of how to follow God and how to obey him. And he said, if you do these things, you'll be resilient. You'll be the man who built his house on the rock and it stands firm. You won't be the one who built his house in the sand. I think in today's world, a lot of these foundational moments for children are lost because at some point someone hands that baby a screen. That face-to-face that they long for, they transfer that energy and become captivated by the screen. It's offering immediate gratification. It lights up when they touch it. They start being formed because we're being formed all the time. And as a baby, we're designed to be formed. For the first 3 months, all they do is they lock onto eyes. mom, dad, grandma, brother, sister. They start being formed into the self and away from what they're designed for. The screen and that time might provide the mom or the dad a few moments of peace, but it comes at the expense of everything that we're looking for on the day that we're born, which is another human being. And everything that that does as humanity longs for authentic connection, to be seen, to be heard, to be loved. These intimate encounters that we have with one another are what make us ourselves. We cannot unlock the true potential growth in us unless we're in that kind of relationship with someone else and we're known and we know them. That's when we can become fully ourselves. And God designed it that way. In our pursuit of technological advancement and our engagement with the technology, I think in a lot of ways we're risking the essential aspects of our humanity. And we're hindering the cognitive and emotional development and spiritual development of our children. I just want to share a few stats. Preschoolers who use screen-based media for more than 1 hour each day have been shown to have significantly less development and core brain regions involved in language and literacy. Brain scans indicate that the more time spent on screens, the lower the child's language skills, the less structural integrity in key brain areas responsible for language. 2 to 5-year-olds with higher levels of screen time showed greater delays in development across a range of important measures, including language, problem solving, and social interaction. Kids are made relational. You can't substitute that with the virtual. The virtual might let a parent have a moment of peace, a kind of peace, but their child is receiving a dopamine hit. That peace is coming at the expense of the development of their personhood. Because we're all designed to have another person in our proximity who's also created in the image of God. Every single person that we meet is an image bearer of God. In the Garden of Eden, God created one man, and there in the garden, before the fall, Adam stood there alone, craving human companionship, and God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." And what exactly is it that God identified as not good before sin had even entered the world? Aloneness. I love Trinitarian theology. It's the best because God is love, and love cannot exist outside of relationship. And so the three persons of God in perfect harmony were made in the image of that, and we likewise cannot exist outside of relationship. God made us in his image, and in that image, we are born needing face-to-face relationship with others of our kind. Solitary confinement that lasts more than 15 consecutive days is recognized by the United Nations as torture. It's especially dangerous for those who are under 21. It can cause permanent psychological damage. I want to run through some more stats. Sorry about this projector being gone. Technology promises a lot of things, but sometimes doesn't deliver, and the lamp burns out before the timer says it's supposed to. So we all got to look over there. For those of you that are over here, you could move over here if you want to see the stats, but social isolation. This is actually the Surgeon General of the United States published an advisory a year ago that we're in the middle of an epidemic of loneliness. And these are the stats, a few of the trends that he published. Social isolation has increased 24 hours per month. Social engagement with friends, 20 hours less per month. I was curious how age groups broke down in this because the Surgeon General's stats in this particular study didn't break it down into generations, so I went looking for data. And as I found it, I found data that actually has a very similar, strikingly similar curve. Look at that. It's just amazing. So if you take all of these and blend them together, you get that. But here's the actual breakdown that I found. This is an American Time Use study. 15 to 24 used to be upwards of 150, maybe up to 160 minutes per day. back in 2003, and here we are, dropped way off. And there's been a change in the older generations, but it's far more pronounced amongst the youth. Social engagement with others, this is just outside of like your friend group. This would be the person at the grocery store, your neighbor, things like that. You're talking over the back fence. It's decreased 10 hours per month. Shared leisure and companionship. This is actually, you're intentionally doing something fun. You've gone fishing with your friend. 14 hours less per month we're doing this as United States residents. Single person households. Somewhere around maybe 12 to 13% of households in 1960 is up almost to 30% now. And then the Surgeon General also had this in the advisory, that isolation, solitary confinement that we're imposing on ourselves or having imposed on us, is having health outcomes that could be worse than smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. I thought that was pretty significant and something to pay attention to. Other data that I was going to use last week from a different study, I decided fit better with today. This is 12th graders, girls on the top, boys on the bottom there. There's usually someone I can talk to if I need to. In 1977, 85% of girls said, yes, I have access to that. Now, it's dropping. And boys always have been a little lower than girls, probably because they don't talk as much, which is actually flipped in my house. The boys talk way more than the girls do. For some reason. Another one, my life isn't useful. This is startling. 1979, that's when I was born. It's such a massive increase after 2011, which is, like, if you were paying attention to my stats from last week, that was my gray line where the smartphone and social media coincided to have more than 50% of the population using it. I'm not really sure why the boys got slightly better there in 2020 during COVID, but I'm not sure what happened there. If you have ideas, come let me know, because I love speculating on these things. But I think we can agree that things aren't good. We're seeing an increase in people basically asking, what is the point of living? And I'm finding myself going back to this infant thing where they look for a face and wondering if that has something to do with it, because if this generation hasn't developed this robust foundation of having their personhood seen and known, they don't know what it's like to be fully human, and they won't be able to stand up to the three enemies of our soul that I've been talking through. Back in 2019, we had our text series. We gave these three exhortations: delight in God, be okay with being different, support one another. And 2 weeks ago, we started with delighting in God, and we said, you know, the enemy of that really is the devil. It's the lies of the devil. And then last week, we talked about being okay with being different. You're going to have different patterns, but it's going to push on you, and that's going to be the flesh that we're resisting. Today, we gave the exhortation, we need to support one another. There's a together aspect in this, and we say that the world is our enemy. Jesus said some things about the world. He said, what good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? He also warned us that there was an enemy of the world. He said, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. And then he goes on to say, remember the word I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master, indicating we're the servants, he's the master. If they persecuted me, Jesus says, they will also persecute you. And so the world, which eventually crucified Jesus, would treat his disciples similarly. So the basic relationship that Christians have to the world is a hostile one. Jesus taught about the world Often it was one of his central ideas. He said, don't love the world. Don't love anything in the world. There's obviously a positive sense to what the world is. They're the people in the world. The world that God loved in John 3:16, where God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. But we're talking today about the negative sense of that world, the systems of practices and standards that are associated with our secular society. It's when the people of the world give in to the lies of the devil, they start believing them, then they give into their flesh, it gets integrated into the mainstream values of what society says is okay, and it gets normalized into all of our systems. Eugene Peterson called that an atmosphere, a mood that's crept into us like a cancerous rot. It's what happens when society tries to eliminate God. And they turn in on their with their flesh and they set themselves up as king with authority instead. Pastor John Mark Comer says it's Adam and Eve's sin, original sin gone viral and spreading throughout humanity. He says the disorder becomes the normative. Sin gets recast as human rights, freedom, reproductive justice, the way things are, nature, science. Boys will be boys, anything but sin. I love that description. Though it's twisted. It's society twisting God's goodness to where, again, as John Mark Comer says, lust is redefined as love. Marriage is redefined not as a covenant of lifelong fidelity, but a contract for personal fulfillment. Divorce is defined as an act of courage and authenticity rather than the breaking of vows. The objectification of women's sexuality through porn is reordered as female empowerment. Greed, well, that's just responsibility to your shareholders. Marxism is justice. And it just keeps on going and going, and we're being formed by these systems even though we don't know it. We have to ask, what is the world doing to shape us from birth? And how do we resist it? And Jesus, in Matthew 16, he had taken his disciples out into the wilderness, and they're just on this dusty hillside, and he's looking at these 12 guys who are youth, probably teenagers, some of them. And he asked them about the authority that God had. And the disciples answered correctly, the Father has all the authority in the world and has given it to Jesus. And on that knowledge, Jesus says, the rock of that knowledge, he says, I will build my church. That God is king and his kingdom cannot be shaken. And on that, I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I like to pray and then get into a little bit more of this. God, I'm so grateful for you and your presence. I think of the first week that we were sharing about all this technology and the lies, and I love just that image we have in the Old Testament of Elisha and his servant and how he asked you to open his servant's eyes so he could see truth and reality, and he opened his eyes and he saw chariots of fire surrounding their enemy. Thank you for week two, where we talked about how spending time with you, the person, changes us. It pushes on our flesh, and it grows us. And inhabited by the Spirit, we have true power. But we've actually got to sit down and do the hard work of spending time with you. But when that Spirit fills us and empowers us, it opens our eyes to see what is true and actually have the true knowledge and wisdom to be able to walk that out. Help us today. I think maybe if there's one thing, it's not necessarily, God, that I want to see a plan for fixing the whole church worldwide, but let each of us come away from today with something, just realizing there's one thing that I need to throw off of myself that the world has given me, because it's hindering the race that I'm running. Through your Holy Spirit, enlighten each one of us to what that is. and then help it go from our head to our heart into our behavior. I pray that something of today would matter 200 years from now in the advancement of your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen. So in week one, I discussed how algorithms and even, you know, curation AI and generative AI are pulling us into these spaces where we may not know what's true. It's isolating people and even pulling them into micro cults all across the internet and causing us to become radicalized. And I think it might be worth looking into the data on a subject, just one, that the world is pushing in on us and saying something about, and what the data actually says, and that is on the role of marriage, and specifically gender roles within that marriage. The world portrays Christian men as abusive, portrays complementarian theology. That's complementarian meaning that men and women are different and that they complement one another in different and unique, distinct roles. Neither one is inferior or superior, but God made us different. But it says that that is oppressive. And I would make the statement, I think, that many are acclimated to that and think it's true. So here's some of what the world is saying. Now, this is a book that's a Christian book, but it says we can no longer deny a link between complementarianism and abuse, meaning if the man is in charge in the marriage, the inevitable result is abuse. Huffington Post. At its core, complementarian theology is one of inequality and hierarchy, and inequality breeds abuse. Cokie Roberts. Conservative Protestant gender ideology can clearly lead to abuse, both physical and emotional, and then Religion Dispatches. Complementarian theology is a breeding ground for abusive marriages. The problem is not just an occasional rotten apple, but a rotten theological tree giving rise to sexism and misogyny. Have you heard the statistic that Christians divorce at the same rate that secular people do? Have you heard that? Well, Brad Wilcox is a sociology professor at the University of Virginia. He analyzed data from three different sources that are pretty common sources for sociologists and scientists, social scientists, and even journalists to pull data from. And what he found, that there's two groups of men. He distinguished these two groups of men who identified as conservative Christians. The first group, devout Christians who attend church three times or more per month. And the second group, who identify as Christian due to maybe a family tie or like a cultural tie, but they rarely, if ever, attend the church. So let's just call them devout and nominal, these two different groups of men. The first group exhibits the lowest rates of domestic violence of any group in America. The second group spends way less time with their children. Wives report significantly lower levels of happiness, and their marriages are far less stable. Here's the actual stats. Devout Christian men who go to church three or more times a month are 35% less likely to divorce than secular men. Nominal, this would be Christian in name only, are 20% more than their secular friends to divorce. 20% more. Devout Christians have the lowest domestic violence rate of any group in the nation at 2.8%. Nominal Christians in name only have the highest rate of any group, 7.2%, even higher than the rate of secular men. Something's wrong with the assumption that Christian men are abusive and that Christian theology leads to abuse. The most violent husbands in America are nominal evangelicals who rarely, if ever, attend church. I find that fascinating. My take on it would be that the world has men who hang around the fringes of the church long enough to hear the language of complementarianism, headship, submission, but not long enough to hear the true biblical meaning of those terms. And they cherry pick Bible verses and read them through this grid of male superiority and entitlement that they've absorbed from the secular guy code of what it means to be a manly man, burping and farting and drinking his beer. So when the world says Christian men are likely to be abusers, they lump these two groups together into one statistic, and it's completely misleading. It's like God's design for human thriving actually works. But Christians aren't going to church anymore. Here's a percentage of Americans who belong to a church. 1999, it's about 70% of Americans. That stat has stayed in the 70% since 1937. And now we're below 50%. It's probably even lower after 2020. Just from this one sort of analysis of the data, I hope you can see that the world brings this data in and then redefines what is good. And it's based on the devil's lies, the desires of the flesh, and they say things that sound pretty darn convincing. And we just start absorbing it, and it starts forming us. But only the Bible is true. It's the only thing worth building our life on. It's the only thing that will make us resilient. So just in case, after last week and the week before, you're still skeptical of all this and you're going out tomorrow to buy your 15-year-old a smartphone, here's some more data. Let's go through this real fast. Children under age 14 spend nearly twice as long with tech devices as they do in conversation with their families. 1 in 4 children have had sexual encounters online with adults via social media. 1 in 3 tween and teen girls have been approached online by adults asking for nudes. I saw a stat that after your daughter gets on Instagram, this is likely to happen within the first week up to a month. 1 in 6 girls ages 9 through 12 have interacted sexually with an adult on these platforms. 40% of 13 to 17-year-olds reported it was normal for people my age to share nudes with each other. 94% of children do not report to a trusted adult when they receive unsolicited nudes. 55% of perpetrators find children again on the same or another platform even after being blocked. 27% of boys aged 9 through 12 use adult dating apps, exposing themselves to sexual predators. How? Why? Why are we giving this to our children? It snuck up on us. The world and its systems says this is normal. This is what everybody should have. Even the Surgeon General is saying things are bad. It's not good for man to be alone, but technology is promising us this self-focused formation, and it's rewiring us. Even artificial intimacy with an AI, which is going to take already fragile people and make them completely unable to deal with the unexpected. Because when you're interacting with an AI, it's always there for you. It never has a bad day. It never bumps up against your preferences. It always caters to your every whim. Project Self. When you're sitting there with that AI and you're sharing your grief and your pain and your longing and your sorrow, it can't relate because those are human experiences. The things that keep you up at night, the things that make you freeze or panic. When you sit with another person face to face who can also feel these things, that is when you're seen and when you're known and when you're understood. That's what makes us human. Even God himself didn't just give us logical proposition in text. After revealing himself through the Old Testament, he came in person to meet us face to face in the form of Jesus Christ. And that's the image that we're supposed to be being formed into, this human image that God himself entered into. And as we interact with one another, our devices threaten to make us so self-focused that we miss the body around us in the church. You know, Jesus' life was given for others. He came to become human, and he died and gave his life for others. He didn't come to be served like our glittering devices serve us, but to serve, to give his life as a ransom for others. A community of love, face to face, where we're sharing what I'm describing, requires other people. He says, by this will all men know that you are really my disciples. It's by the quality of the love you have for one another. I could give a lot of practical advice today. Radical parenting tips, practical handles on what to do with your cell phone, age limits on things. My family has really, in my opinion, since the moment of Emery's birth, thought a bit radically about this because I saw it coming. But I'm hesitant to just share all those practices with you guys because we humans are like Pharisees and we like to take good practices and good advice and adopt them as biblical rules and truth to get a sense of righteousness out of it, like I'm performing well, and so I hesitate. But I do want to share that we kept the screen out of our kids' hands until they were a bit older, and even then it's moderated in such a way that they have very limited access. We started iPad time with them on Friday afternoons where they could have just a short period of time to play a game on the family iPad, and I don't actually remember the last time that iPad came out. Every once in a while they'd ask for it, like on a down day, can we have iPad time? I feel like it's been over a month. It's like they moderate it themselves now because they recognize what it does to their brains. We don't do screens in the car. Again, I'm just sharing some things. I don't want to give you guys rules, and I'll share why in a second, in addition to what I just shared. We took a 4,000-mile road trip last summer with no screens, and the kids were not at each other's throats. They did not melt down, even after driving 9 hours a day for several days in a row. They read books, they played games, we talked, we had deep conversations. We enjoyed it. We recently bought a new Suburban. It has two screens in the back. You can play DVDs, and they sit there with their headphones. And so we took our first trip, and we popped in a movie, because, wow, this is novel. This is really cool. And the kids sat back there with their headphones, and Sarah and I sat in the front and listened to a podcast. And later on, as we were heading back home, Emery said, I didn't like that. I wasn't even going to share anything. I had already felt it, but he said it out loud because of the way that we've patterned our family. And he said, I like when we travel for hours and talk. I prefer that. Can we not watch screens in the car anymore? It's not legalistic. We might watch a movie one time on a trip. I don't know. We don't impose it on them, but they're imposing it on themselves now that they've seen the benefits to their own brains to be free from screens. I could give you a lot of tips, but I don't want you to become, you know, Pharisees about it. I don't want us to do that, but we've got to support one another. I think the full implications, here's my reason, the full implications of what's coming next with technology haven't fully manifested themselves. We don't know what this next culture is going to look like. We're only catching glimpses of it at this point. So to give tangible rules or practical advice on how to engage with it may be a little short-sighted right now, which means that as a group, what I am calling you into with me is to sit with God together, separately probably at first, like what I described last week, be the tree by the water in the middle of the desert, and ask him, God, what do you want me to do in my family? What should my household look like? What do I need to change? What do you see coming that I can't foresee? And then come together with your small group or that close, trusted friend and share together what God told you, because he's going to tell you something. He may tell you something through them. Don't underestimate that. And then together, as we sit face to face in larger and larger groups, we can come to some practical solutions that are rooted in biblical truth and who God is and how he inhabits us and what he's made the church to be. I read a book this spring on AI by Eric Schmidt. He's Google's chief executive officer. Daniel Huttenlocher, he's the dean of a college of computing at MIT. And Henry Kissinger, of all people. Those three wrote a book on AI. It was fascinating. From a very secular perspective, their conclusion kind of shocked me. It was a pretty bleak book, talking about the potential problems, kind of likening the AI race to the nuclear arms race where nobody wins in the end. At the end of the book, they said, programmers and scientists and engineers, the ones that are bringing AI to us, they don't have the understanding necessary to set the ethics with what humans need to do with it. And their conclusion was, hey, philosophers and theologians, would you please step in to understand this so you can guide us? The secular world is waking up to the fact that their institutions, their values, their systems of thought, their ways of organizing have failed the world. They're seeing it as their youth fall into depression, anxiety, and suicide, and they're looking at it and they're going, nothing works. Help. Atheists like Richard Dawkins just a few weeks ago, he said, I'm functionally a Christian. I can't believe in the supernatural, but I'm functionally Christian because there is no other worldview that leads to human thriving. So I have no choice but to say the Christian ethic is the one to build your foundation on. The world's atheists are coming around. There's an open door in a world where everybody is sharing their opinion about how bad things are. There's a rise in evangelism from Hindus and Muslims because they're seeing an open door. Where are we at? Where are we at? I think of Jesus when he looked at the world. He saw the crowds. He had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. That's the world we live in, church. Those are the people around us in our schools, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, and even sometimes in our families. And look at this, what he says next. He says to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. I think my concern, my primary concern with all of this technology is that we're content to sit and be numbed rather than stepping into our place at this point in the timeline of working for the Lord for the harvest. Did you notice in the series, it's the youth that are being affected the most? So are you thinking 60 years down the road? Maybe it's past your lifespan. We can't continue as we have for the last generation or two and assume things are going to be okay. Look at the results. Like, we all know the statistics. We've been hearing for several years now, like 70% of our students hit college and walk away from the faith. Like, seriously, in corporate America, if you had any group that was doing that poorly in their results, you'd throw their process in the garbage and start over. Right? I was just trying to think about how our typical kid grows up today in the church. It's like they're dropped into this system, like this high-dollar travel sports system that basically lets them know performing on a field at an adolescent level is everything. And we're gonna rearrange the whole family's schedule and lifestyle around it, or insert any other thing. It could be academics. It could be getting your college degree. It could be setting you up for the right career. We're going to organize our whole family's schedule around it. And then simultaneously, we hand them a cell phone where they're exposed to all the darkness of all humanity, and we expect them to be okay. That's a provocative statement. It poked on some of you probably. And I'm okay with that because we're looking at something different than I think we've seen before. I think you could maybe in good conscience say that our previous couple of generations could blend in with the world and still maintain a bit of a semblance of a Christian worldview without much trouble. I would argue that maybe the last couple generations of the American church have kind of been asleep and needed to be poked and woken up. And I'm hoping this cultural moment wakes us up to the power of the Holy Spirit and what he wants to do with us and in us in the harvest in this next culture. So I want to close because we're going to run over time again. And I would like for us to sing a song at the end because I think it's just settling for our souls. But I just want to share a story, if you guys would oblige me. Prior to my sabbatical last summer, I was processing all of this information and thinking about my kids and this 70% walk away from the church statistic and seeing in the families that I knew that playing out in real time. And just wondering, is it just luck of the draw? My three kids, just one out of the three is going to make it? Or is there something I can do? And I was feeling really discouraged by that. And then at the beginning of my sabbatical, we went to my grandmother's funeral in Wisconsin. She was born in 1923. She died in 2023. There were 99 people in her clan, her four boys and their wives and their kids, down to the grandkids, great-grandkids. 99 people. Of those 99 people, only two families not following the Lord. There are theologians, there are pastors, there are worship leaders, there are seminary professors amongst my cousins. My Uncle Scott shared during the service about his brothers and about their wives and about his kids and their kids. And he shared about Grandma Betty's life, specifically her prayer life, where she prayed for every single person in her family by name every single day. Without fail, one at a time, 99 people. And that went all the way back to her youth, where she had started doing that with her family. I remember a long time ago, my dad saying the secret of his success was his mom praying for him. And my Uncle Scott got up and shared, and he outlined all of this to everybody in the room, and he said, "This didn't happen by accident." And that's been resonating with me ever since, rolling around in my head. The whole weekend was about her legacy, how one person's faith could transform generations of believers. And it gave me hope for the future of my kids. And thinking, instead of thinking, I guess we just play the odds, one in three of them will follow the Lord. Jesus gave us one institution, the church. He could have given us all kinds of things, but he gave us the church. What was different about my grandmother is she saw hers and her family's place in the church, their little country church in Ogama, Wisconsin. And she's taken her place now in the great cloud of witnesses, like in Hebrews 12, Hebrews 11. The hall of faith, those who have gone before us, what an incredible legacy of faith and investment in the middle of so many crises across the history of the world. I just think of those people, Moses, Abraham, Enoch, my grandmother, as they held babies and looked in their faces, as they passed their faith on from generation to generation. If you look back on generations, there's probably only 80 to 100 people between us and the time of Christ. Did you know that? They'd easily fit in one of these sections of pews. Just handing the faith off, face to face, and that person turns around and hands it to the next generation, face to face. When my mother sat with me and shared the gospel with me when I was 4 years old, she handed me the faith. The Hall of Faith ends, all those people who have gone before and all of the things that they did, culminating in us. And Hebrews says, therefore, since we are surrounded by them, such a great cloud of witnesses from the past generations, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. Band, why don't you guys come on up and let's get ready for the last song. Will Summit View Church, regardless of what comes next in our culture, Again, I'm not a doom and gloom guy. I'm actually optimistic because God's church always prevails against the gates of hell. His Spirit is the only power we're supposed to be seeking right now. Will Summit View Church be shaping our world for Jesus Christ 200 years from now? My family thus far has not happened by accident. This church, Summit View, is the reason I met and married my wife. My kids are radically different because of you in this room. We just saw baby dedications and we just pledged to stick with those families and stick with those babies and be face to face in relationship with them. They're going to be radically different because of that investment for life. Your faces, your voices have impacted and invested in my family. It's wired so deeply into us, it cannot be separated. We're so deeply imprinted. I'm so grateful for that gift that God has given in this body, in this fellowship. So like I said, I don't want to give us a plan. Here's how we're practically going to fight AI. I want to call us into the gathering of God's people, his ecclesia, his called out ones. I want us to gather around the table. I want us to break bread together, to look each other in the eye, to recognize each other, to know and be known. And then I want us collectively to ask God, what do you want us to do? And then ask him to fill us with his Holy Spirit's power. And then I want us to look each other in the face and send each other out into the world to glorify God and to make heaven a more crowded place for centuries to come. Let's not get stuck on trivial things like how much screen time do I get today? Irrelevant, unless it's pulling you away from what I just described that the church could be. So the second half of this verse, we're over, so I'll just share it. How do we throw off everything that hinders? Notice the distinction and the sin. There's sin and there's everything that hinders. Everything that hinders could be a very good thing. It might be your technology. It could be something else, but we need discernment. And how do we do that? We look to Jesus, the author, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising its shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. When you get there with him someday after, you know, he's preparing a home for you. What patterns of living differently now will you look back on and go, I'm so glad I made that investment. I'm so glad I spent time with that person. What are you going to look back on with regret and say, I wasted my time and energy and money on something that was meaningless, that ended up destroying my family? It was just a hindrance in running this race. Let's look to Jesus to found and perfect our faith together as we run this race.